All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Nancy Evans, along with Candace Carpenter, founded iVillage in the mid-1990s. iVillage was one of the first community-focused sites on the early web, and it grew to be one of the biggest of its kind. Not only was iVillage a site and a company founded by women, but it was also among the first sites that targeted women as a demographic in the early web era. Nancy recounts for us the development of the company, the benefits and pitfalls involved in being one of the highest flying companies of the dot-com era, and gives us some powerful perspective on the role women have played from the very beginning of the web era. I should note here that this was a bit of a star-crossed interview session that involved several interruptions to our discussion. As well, there is a small background buzz during the first half of our talk that I do apologize for. It goes away halfway through. But frankly, there have been way worse episodes previous to this one in terms of sound quality. And the quality of the conversation is fantastic, so small technical issues aside, I'm sure you're absolutely going to love this conversation with iVillage co-founder Nancy Evans. Nancy Evans, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
You're welcome.
I do like to start off with a little bit of people's background, so I was curious where you grew up.
I grew up in Fairfield, Connecticut, which people always say, oh, gosh, you know, I guess you grew up in New York City because it's so nearby, but it was really quite different than growing up in a big city. It was a real small town. Everyone knew my grandparents, my parents, all my teachers knew. Mm-hmm. I mean, you always felt watched. You had to behave well.
So a small town upbringing in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you went to college. You went to Skidmore College.
Yeah. And yeah.
What was your degree?
Well, no, I transferred to Wesleyan. It was like during the time of women's colleges and men's colleges beginning to kind of, you know, go, hey, is single sex the way to go? So my major was English. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Columbia for a master's in 17th century literature.
Mm.
And given that there were very few role models back there, a lot of my role models were professors, you know, and I thought that would be a pretty good life.
And I guess with that sort of a degree, publishing is a logical place to go for a career.
Well, no, not actually.
No.
No, it wasn't logical. I had published a lot before before college and during college. So I'd always been a writer and I'd gotten, you know, published in academic journals and, you know, American Scholar and things like that as an academic, you know, where you always use the word one would think, for instance. And then I got published, you know, an essay I wrote about not making Sylvia Plath my role model, because Sylvia Plath was very popular during my day as a smart woman who did achieve something, but then ultimately did commit suicide. So I thought that part of it was time to get over that being part of the role model. So I wrote a piece that got published in Glamour. So I was always getting published, and I had edited some stuff. And when I was in graduate school, being in the 17th century, I began pining to be in what was then the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I mean, that I really wanted to get into real publishing and not stay in academia.
So would you say that your publishing career sort of starts at Harper's?
Yes.
Is that skipping over something?
No, that's probably where it starts.
And you're at Harper's for what, 5 or 6 years?
This is when you can't count on me, because I'm not so good at all the chronology. Mm-hmm. No, I was probably there for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And I need to say that one of the things about Harper's was that there was a section of the magazine back then called Wraparound, which was very much coming out of the Whole Earth Catalog, Stewart Brand, 60s kind of ethos. Mm-hmm. And the Wraparound section of the magazine was, rather than having just, Saul Bellow and Norman Mailer, who were regular, Tom Wolfe, mm-hmm. they were regular writers back then for Harper's.
Right.
It was to add in voices from readers. Mm. It was to add in voices from normal people. Mm. And you would take a theme, money, power, work, and in this 24-page wraparound insert on the magazine, you talk about that subject with famous names, cheek by jowl, with, Brian McCullough and mm-hmm. Nancy Evans. Mm-hmm. No names. nice no names, but no names. And I loved that way of kind of creating journalism. And there was then a spinoff called Harper's Weekly.
Right.
Because Harper's Weekly, along with the magazine, were both these, 19th century publications. Mm-hmm. And so Harper's Weekly was revived, which was called a reader-written newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very webby in its
premise. Thinking of the audience as material.
And as participants.
Right.
That you're the heroes here.
Well, that obviously will serve you well soon, but... so you're a contributing editor to Glamour for about 8 years or so. So that gets into the woman focused publishing arena. You're also you write for a bunch of places, but you're also the editor in chief of the Book of the Month Club,
mm-hmm.
and you launch a magazine with Jan Wenner as your partner, I think.
Oh, that's way later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Way later.
But I'm sort of hopping around here, but I want to get a sense of, so you have this experience working in publishing, working in female-focused publishing as well, and how that's preparing you for what's coming up.
I think more than the female focus, because was the coming out of Harper's with another Harper's magazine editor, I co-authored a book called How to Get Happily Published.
Mm.
The happily is the key word in that, because lots of people get published, but they don't get published happily. Mm. They get published miserably. They go, my mother can't find my book. Mm. Where is it? They're very unhappy. And that book was really a way to level the playing field, so that anyone who had a story to tell,
mm-hmm.
anyone who had something important to say, we were giving them the etiquette of how to get published.
Mm.
That was very important, because mm-hmm. I believe that lots of people didn't get published not because they didn't have a good story. It's because they just didn't know, the ins and outs mm-hmm. of the elite publishing world. So really, that's my DNA, is breaking down barriers.
Hmm.
That I was allowed into elite settings where all I wanted to do was to change the rules. So I think that's my DNA.
Give really. more people a voice, essentially.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So trying to get us up to the iVillage days, I think I'll also include, you were the president and publisher of Doubleday.
Right.
Lots of famous books,
right.
Best-selling books you bring to market and things like that.
Right.
Acknowledging that I'm jumping ahead,
mm-hmm.
where are we in the early mid-90s when, first of all, how did you know Candace Carpenter?
Well, it's the 90s. I'll go back to that.
Uh-huh.
By the 90s, I had started a magazine called Family Life,
mm-hmm.
In large part because I had a child and looked around at the parenting magazines that were current then, and they were just incredibly female-centric, white centric, stick in the house centric, and I thought there's got to be a better magazine than this to address, you know, parents raising kids that would include fathers, that would include different ethnicities, and that would talk about sports, of which I'm a big fan. So I started this magazine called Family Life, and I was talking to Time Inc., whom I'd worked for at Book of the Month, about publishing it, and then I talked to Jan Wenner. So we began, we formed a partnership and started publishing that magazine, which in its first year was nominated for the National Magazine Award, which was pretty neat. And Candace at that point was working with Barry Diller, had just started working with him to start a QVC for what we called baby boomers, you know, people who wouldn't be caught dead buying on QVC. And she, unbeknownst to me, was using the visuals from Family Life to present her parenting show on Q2.
Right.
That is how we met, when Jan said, we need to have a meeting with these people because they're using our artwork without our permission.
Okay.
So really, that is how we met, was at a meeting at a very long conference table. And Barry Diller was there, Jan was there, lots of other men, and then Candace and I were the two women.
So that's interesting that you meet sort of in adversarial circumstances, but yet...
Yet respect. I mean, she... She was using Family Life in her demo because she thought it was so beautiful, which was a compliment, you know. So we worked it out. And then we actually worked together to do the parenting show on Q2.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you had worked together in some capacity previous to the iVillage project starting.
Yeah.
So what is your recollection? I know that it didn't start as iVillage, but what is your recollection of how the project that became iVillage started? When did you first hear about it and that sort of thing?
Well, our company name was OSI Village.
Okay.
We started as iVillage. No, how it started was that Candace was doing consulting work for AOL. And one has to remember that back in, this is now like 1994, that, you know, AOL is known, but it's not world known the way it was to come to be. World Wide Web, that is like nowhere on the horizon with most of the country. So as the AOL discs start coming out, reference your earlier podcast with Jan Brandt, the AOL discs go out. I ignore them completely. You know, they're coming in my house every day. Candace sends me one because she's doing consulting at AOL and says, please, would you take a look at this? I stick it in my computer, which is also new, right? Us even having computers. And I look at this thing called AOL, and I think, wow, this is the most primitive thing I've ever seen. I mean, there is no sound.
Right.
There are no moving images.
Right.
I mean, it's almost, it's like a Bob Newhart sketch. You know, it was like, and the only thing that saved me in my perception of it was I just happened at that point to be reading a history of the beginning of television. Which was really lucky, because the history of television, at the beginning, it was so primitive, of course. It was black and white. There was, you know, a talking head, not a moving head. They didn't even move the heads then. There was just a talking head on the screen. So that made me realize, okay, this is just the beginning. And it really is primitive, but here's the good news. It's got a long way to go, and we're, you know, I'm really good at, you know, producing and creating, I don't know if we want to use the word content, but I know how to, you know, work with media. So I started getting kind of excited about it after I got over being so frustrated by it, because I really didn't know. You click on something, I really didn't know where I was going, didn't know how to get back. And you got to remember that AOL was the training wheels to get onto the web, and I couldn't even get the training wheels. You know, and I'm pretty smart, I'm Phi Beta Kappa, I couldn't figure it out. So I figured if I can't figure it out, there's got to be a lot of people out there, whether they're male, female, whatever, who need more help.
Let me ask you, what did you think of the content that you saw on AOL? Was that also primitive in the sense that, you know, this would be rejected from any magazine in the world? This is just garbage that they're throwing up.
The content was pretty primitive, yes, compared to magazine or book publishing, where you've got a... You've got an army of professional writers, you've got professional editors, you've got copy editors, you've got proofreaders, which reminds me, by the way, that when we did start our first website at iVillage, I was actually going into the message boards to copy edit them. I mean, that is how, you know, I mean, I came out of traditional publishing.
Right,
I wanted this thing to be perfect. And,
right.
you know, then one day I went, okay, this is life. This is the way it is. And
right.
I embraced the typos and the misspellings. What was your question?
How did you first hear about let's do this ourselves?
Oh, I know. You were asking about how the content was on AOL.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I want to skip to what I did see and get excited about was their message boards and their chat rooms. I mean, what AOL was onto early was the web being a place where people could find other like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
And that you could have these communities, you could have these support groups, that was kind of the secret sauce.
So your two insights are is that this is very early days, so you know there's an opportunity here to do something well.
Right.
And also that the real key, the killer app, is the people talking to each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then, who is the one that has the idea that, hey, why don't we do this ourselves if we don't think it's there yet?
It's a combination. I think what happened was, at this point, there's Steve Case at AOL and Ted Leonsis. Steve and Ted, and they had just gotten research in. And remember, at this point, even having metrics in the early days of the web was not so... I mean, I used to hand count our traffic before we had any kind of reports. But AOL had just had a first report that showed that women were coming on in significant enough numbers onto AOL that, you know, it made their heads kick back. And they... thought there's something, there's a market here that we need to encourage. And just to underline that, when I was doing the magazine Family Life, it was just at the point where Starwave, I don't know if you're going to do something about the Starwave guys, I had a meeting almost every week in my office with somebody wanting to put my magazine online because I was addressing parents. And AOL wasn't the only one seeing that mothers in big numbers, fathers too, but mothers in big numbers were coming online. So I was getting offers a lot to put my magazine online. That was during the shovelware period to give the newfangled web
content.
Some credibility and content was to bring on traditional magazines. And of course, I kept saying, I don't get it. You know, like, why would somebody want to read the magazine online when they can get in this beautiful package? And anyway, where's the business model? Like, where's the money in this? Which no one really had a good answer for. But in short, creating programming for parents was the golden, you know, it was the holy grail right at that point in 1995.
So initially, isn't Candace starting to create some stuff like that for AOL? Maybe family women-based channels on AOL, is that right?
No, they were doing research,
okay.
consulting, but no content was created till we founded iVillage.
Okay.
And then we did the first parenting site then.
So, again, who do you feel like is the person that gets this together and says, let's do this?
I think it's Ted, Steve, Candace... I mean, it's them coming together.
And you, when this idea does come together, you know that you want to do it on the web. The web is, you feel like, is it reaching that critical mass now where you see that's the way to go? That's where we plant our flag?
It wasn't critical mass. I mean, when you think back to the numbers, they were so little back in 94, 95.
There could be 10 million total people in the world
on the web.
Right.
Right. And a lot of people, if you pointed out a www dot, you know, on a billboard somewhere, they would go, you know, what's that?
Sure.
It was still rare to even see www dot, you know, on a billboard. So no, I don't think we thought it was a no brainer. I think it was that if anything was taking off, it was AOL. AOL is just critical to the story of the web exploding. So if there was beginning to be maybe not a mass audience, but the beginning of a consumer audience, it was on AOL. So that was the engine that made it interesting. The other thing that made it interesting was that there was no what I would call quality programming yet. And how neat to see if we could invent it. Mm-hmm. I mean, with seriously, you know, beautiful graphics and fabulous writing and you know, create a place that was visually and emotionally and intellectually beautiful.
So I know that this might be hard to nail down exact dates, but when, just for the context, when are we starting iVillage as a project? Is it late 94, early 95-ish?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And because I'm super curious about this, if you, your memory of, okay, what's the first thing we're going to put out there? I believe it's Parent Soup is what happens.
Yes.
But what are you envisioning putting out there when you first are doing the project?
For Parent Soup or for iVillage?
For whatever the first of this project is.
Okay.
Is it taking a magazine and putting it online? Because I get the sense, I don't want to lead you with the question, but I get the sense that, again, you had to rediscover that community was where it was at. So do you launch with magazine-style content first and then realize, oh, everybody's running to the message boards?
Yeah, this is what... Mm-hmm. Because... I wanted to, yes. So now we start down in a room in this house. We're plugging in computers with all these, you know, none of us know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Sparks are flying out. Yeah, and we start creating content. Mm-hmm. We start writing literally thousands of articles. When it goes up on AOL, which would then be the February of 95? Anyway, all I know is when we begin to launch Parent Soup, I'm calling the guys down in Vienna, Virginia, going, do you have us up yet? Do you have us up yet? Mm-hmm. And they went, what, are you kidding me? First of all, there's a blizzard, so none of them are at work. And I keep going, don't you guys have four-wheel drive? You know, like, we got to get up today. Finally, some guys get to the office. And they had never seen this much content in the history of AOL. Mm. I mean, we were putting up a website 10 times larger than anything they had ever seen. Why? Because I want to knock the socks off the world. Uh-huh. I want it to be the best website anyone's ever seen. Mm-hmm. So you're right. I mean, have I forgotten about the community? Well, at the point that when you open up the doors to your store,
right,
you've got merchandise there. That's what's going to bring them in. Mm-hmm. And in our case, the merchandise is the way we look on the page, the way we feel, you know, what our headlines say. How much depth we got, the voice, I made the voice very different than a magazine voice. It was much, we had shorter sentences like you would on TV or probably on your podcast. Mm-hmm. You know, we modified it for the web, but the content was the only thing we had to bring them in. And then you're quite right. Once they came in, yeah, they read the content, but the content was the friggin' appetizer. Uh-huh. They would nibble at that and go, that's good. You know, and they kind of got a feeling of trust, right? Because this content was not crazy. You know, we had vetted it. Mm-hmm. We had it in, you know, in health, food, you know, toddlers, babies, pregnancy, you name it. But then they congregated at the message boards. They began talking to each other. They began saying, oh my, I mean, like, I remember this one mother going, I am just so thrilled to be talking to someone today who can talk in complete sentences. You know, she was just so frigging relieved not to be, she loves her kids, but enough already. And they were so funny and so cool. And then I spent the rest of my time listening to those message boards. I mean, it was the heartbeat of everything.
But you think that it's important to note that you might, without the credibility of the content at the beginning, it might not have lent credibility enough to the site for the community to take off.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, they were like proud of it. And, you know, I mean, they being the people who came to Parent Soup, was they felt it was a safe place, which was important back then. The web was really kind of scary. And even on AOL, you could go into a message board and, you know, there'd be one message saying, hi, is anyone there? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe then 2 hours later, someone would put a post up going, I'm here. Well, we didn't want there to be that much of a lonely experience. Mm-hmm. So to really be a good host meant you overserved, you put out more hors d'oeuvres probably than they could eat.
Right.
But I think it was essential. It was essential both to the audience and, frankly, it was essential to the business model, because we had brought in the first, we really did, iVillage brought in the first blue chip sponsorships, mm-hmm. you know, of companies that never would have set foot on the web. Well, but we gave them a comfort level by the quality of what we were putting up that they were making deals with us to be there.
Before we get into the business angle of it, uh-huh. I want to still talk about the content a little bit more because Robert Levitin told me that you had three tent poles, I think, family, health, and career, right? Is that sort of that's the guiding mission in terms of the content and the areas that you're going into?
No, not that. At that point, we really were just doing parenting.
Okay.
That was it. Mm. And it wasn't till, first of all, to put up, I keep saying to everyone, you know, putting up a website may seem easy, but to maintain a website, to, you know, feed and bathe and mm-hmm. keep it breathing, that, you know, that's the real trick, is the maintenance. So doing Parent Soup alone was already a huge project that mm-hmm. was taking, you know, a lot of staff. So to go into other verticals at that point really wasn't in the cards financially or mentally in terms of what we could do. What we did see, of course, is that when people talk about their kids and raising their kids and all the issues that come up, you know, they, of course, then talk about their work, mm-hmm. like how the heck am I going to keep my job mm-hmm. while I'm raising this kid, or, you know, should I start to work from home? You know, how do I get dinner on the table? So they start talking about food. Mm-hmm. You know, where's my husband in all this? Why isn't he helping out? So they talk about relationships. So we knew there were all kinds of vertical subjects that we could start addressing when we got the bandwidth. Mm-hmm. So then listening to that kind of heartbeat from the message boards, we did start designing where we could go next. And that's when we started thinking about expanding from Parent Soup to a larger network, which originally, by the way, we called Life Soup, going off the branding of Parent Soup. And then we took our company name, iVillage, and called it iVillage.com, the women's network.
Just real quickly, because I, being from that era, hear that and I think Talk Soup. Is that by any chance where the inspiration?
Well, I mean, we had something called Chat. Yes, probably.
Right.
Probably. Right. Yeah.
So when iVillage, when it morphs into iVillage, is the idea then to create a tentpole like structure where there's different verticals underneath it?
Yes.
And
yes.
Was that always successful, or did you have to evolve that over time as well?
That was pretty much successful from the get-go.
Okay.
Probably because Parent Soup had become the number one parenting site online. We had become pretty huge. So that when we then added on, you know, what Robert was saying, we mm-hmm. added on health and we added on work. As we started adding these other channels, we pretty much were bringing people in mm-hmm. from the very opening of that. The other thing we learned, by the way, which also helped us in expanding, was back to what you said about community ruling over the content, mm-hmm. was we understood, rather than doing what we'd done with Parent Soup and having put so much work into it, making it so perfect, was instead of having it all done and then you invite the guests in, we had it just a little bit done and let them come in and they showed the paths, you know, mm-hmm. where to make the sidewalks rather than us making the sidewalks before they arrived. Mm-hmm. So that was really important. So we put less up than we did in the first website.
That's interesting to me because coming from a publishing background, you know, one of the things that people are always critical of, old media doesn't get it because they're used to telling the audience, this is what's important. Was that a difficult transition for you coming from publishing?
Yeah. Not as hard as it was for some of my compatriots. Mm-hmm. I mean, partly because, yes, publishing is top down. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're the experts, you're the editors, you know, in the offices who are assigning things out. Mm-hmm. You're the one coming up with the story ideas. The web, is the complete opposite. You listen to the message boards to hear what they're saying. And that's what you pull up to headline as a story. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that kept coming up was, you know, parents of teenagers were the most crazed. Well, there's parents of babies. They have a pretty rough life. But mm-hmm. parents of teenagers were out of their minds because teenagers, you know, they have these nice kids, and then one day
right.
the parents wake up and they go, who is this child? Mm-hmm. You know, they won't talk to me, they won't wash dishes, they won't help, I hate them. So these parents joined together to see if they did not nag their children for 1 week, was there a possibility that their teenager might behave better, right?
Mm-hmm.
They did that by themselves, these parents on the Parents of Teenager message board. And I watched these, I mean, I was watching this. I felt, I mean, how could you not love that these parents joined together to do this? And you know what? It kind of worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their kids kind of behaved better. We went on the Today Show with these mothers to go, holy smokes. You know, when parents come together, they can come up with some solutions. So the answer to your question is, I fell in love with the women. They are so cool. And the way they came up with solutions to their problems, and they're so funny. They're so funny. That it was really easy, given my background already, was to break the barriers down, to mm-hmm. let everyone in, and mm-hmm. let them tell their stories. I went right down the rabbit hole with them
mm-hmm.
To really show how smart they are. And you know, another thing, we took it out to print because the print world was still doing what the print world was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But we brought it out by the New York Times Magazine did a whole issue on kind of the state of women.
Mm-hmm.
And on every page of that issue, there was a quote from an iVillage woman. I mean, we started showing these women who, in the beginning of the web, you know, most people thought the women online must be weirdos. Really, I mean, particularly when we went out to advertisers, they just said, you know, they must be living in, I don't know, some hovel somewhere. And we took, I went out there and we took pictures of the women using iVillage
mm-hmm.
to convince people these were real women. they were head of their PTAs. They were normal, neat women. I mean, it was that primitive early on.
You know, so we're talking about how you have to learn new things coming from publishing into this new medium. But also, there's a conflict in the sense that you're operating in a tech world. But I think I saw on your Charlie Rose interview, which, by the way, was 16 years ago yesterday, coincidentally. But,
whoa, yesterday.
Yesterday. Yeah. That you said that from day one you knew that it was a media company, not a tech company.
Oh, yeah.
So there's conflict there.
Well, that's really important because, okay, do I know anything about tech? I mean, you and I were just setting up your computer and doing that. You know, at least I can do that. But I mean, once Candace and I were sitting on the server, you know, and the tech guys came running over and said, you know, the whole company's there and you're about to blow it up. And we're going, really? You know, so we didn't know exactly what we were doing. But that was a true, true advantage because I was going, you bet, I know nothing about tech. But neither does the million of women out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went at it like, what makes sense to us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what kind of navigation makes sense to us? Sometimes the tech guys would come in with, you know, what I would call whizzy bang, just something really cool they'd invented,
mm-hmm.
you know, and smoke's coming out. And I go, this is really cool, but what does it do? Like, what does it do that would help a woman get something done
mm-hmm.
in a day?
Mm-hmm.
And they would go, don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I go, okay, go back and, you know, into the lab
mm-hmm.
and see what you can cook up that would be good. So we kind of were representative mm-hmm. of the consumer out there.
Mm-hmm. But did that cause you problems in terms of raising money for the project because you have to go to VCs who are used to funding tech and software-based companies, and you're saying, no, this is some weird hybrid. This is not tech. It's more media, but it's not traditional media. Did that make things difficult, being sort of in between?
Huh. I don't remember them going, wait a minute, you don't know anything about tech. How are you going to do this?
Mm-hmm.
What I remember most is women.
Mm-hmm.
No one thought women were going to get computers, let alone go online. That was the issue. Because you got to remember that in 1995, when we're going out to venture capitalists, mm-hmm. we get $2 million from AOL.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're on airplanes going out to these VCs.
Mm-hmm.
There's, depending upon the statistics, it's either less than 13%, less than 19% of the people online are women. There are very few women online. So when we go to Kleiner Perkins, for instance,
mm-hmm.
any of those VCs, they're going, hey, my wife doesn't even own a computer, let alone is online. Why would women ever want to do this? And we said, exactly. That is where we come in. We have been in the market of creating stuff for women, you know, between us for decades. And what we want to do is to create the reason why women would come onto the web. And that was our proposition. And we said, watch this. Once we get started, this will be one of the greatest appliances women have ever found to help them get stuff done in their lives. And watch this. One day, there will be more women online than men. And they looked at us like we were frigging crazy. Until, by the way, John Doerr got it handed to him, who's also been in the news lately. John Doerr got on the phone, called Will Hurston, called in a few other partners, because he said, these women won't leave my office. And they invested in us early. And, you know, once we kind of had their imprimatur, more venture capitalists thought, well, there must be something here.
Well, then let's do get to the business side, too, then, because it surely helped that you guys, from the get-go, were getting major Fortune 500 brands to sponsor you.
Yeah.
And so then maybe that's where your background from publishing and media helped in that regard.
Absolutely. That helped a lot, because we had been out, you know, meeting and selling to these Fortune 500 companies. The other thing we knew was how important in magazine publishing, you go out with what's called a prototype, you know, of what your magazine's going to be, you know, before it's been on the newsstands. So we created a really robust prototype of Parent Soup, you know, on a computer, and we brought it out on our sales calls so you could really show this is real. You know, this isn't some, you know, smoke and mirrors thing. So it was very important to show realness. Because remember, they're used to the sponsors going on a television show, going in a print magazine, and this thing called the web just seemed ephemeral to them. You know, what is it? Where is it? So it was very important that we did so much legwork early on.
And I ask everybody this from this era because it's fascinating coming from 2015, but what sort of analytics and data are you able to give to your sponsors and things like that, because there's not the analytics that we know today. So what are you able to show them?
Okay, can I tell you one thing?
Sure.
Okay, so we're in our little New York office. I call down to Vienna, Virginia, AOL, and I go, hey, can you guys send us your boilerplate contract for advertisers? Maybe I was talking to the wrong person, but they said, we don't have one. I said, you must have some kind of contract. No. I mean, it was so, things were so early on the advertising front. I mean, sometimes you didn't know who was paying who, you know, who was the buyer, who was the seller. So our, yes, you're quite right. On the first charter sponsors we had, which is selling companies in before you've gone live, we were selling them in to the promise of, they were investing in us almost as much as the venture capitalists. And they were, you know, putting up relatively big money for that time. I mean, really big money for that time. And that was based, like VCs, I would say, it was based on us, who we were, you know, because we worked, all of us had worked a really long time and new media. And it was based on the fact that AOL was our platform. We went onto the web after we first won an AOL. And for many years, we're programming both to AOL and to the web. So we did have metrics from AOL, right? We had some traffic numbers, and we really knew, we could guesstimate what our traffic would be on AOL. So we were able to give, you know, some numbers, and we were able to give, like you do in a magazine, some guarantees. So and we also said to them, we are going to get a lot of publicity and a lot of visibility, in part because this is the first big women's play. And you will be part of that, you sponsor. So we will also help raise your profile.
Let's talk about competition at the time. There's competition on one level in the sense that at some point, 96, 97, 98, the idea of building community sites is not such a crazy idea. It becomes one of the fads of the era almost. So you're... There's other sites out there like GeoCities, The Globe, and things like that that are trying to do similar community things. But also, I mean, What about competitors like women.com? Oprah gets involved at some point, mm-hmm. when it launches the Oxygen Network and things like mm-hmm. that. So what was the sense of competitiveness to make iVillage be the premier destination for this audience?
Well, we are completely competitive. Mm-hmm. so we were competitive. And I think why we were bigger, better, and why we were number one is, well, in the case of Oprah and Oxygen, to your earlier point, they came from traditional media, mm-hmm. and they didn't kind of stay. You got to hang out with the web to really know how it works, and they didn't give it time to really know how it works. So mm-hmm. their programming was still the old, you know, old traditional media top down. So I think that was their issue. With women.com, I think where we won over them, and actually that was in the, you can see it in the numbers, our community was just that much stronger. And when I talk about our community being stronger, its numbers were just exponentially larger than theirs. And it's in large part because we didn't just put message boards up and say, you know, here's a topic, you know, go talk among yourselves. We developed from the people who were on the message boards, the most present people on the message boards, the most helpful, we created a cadre of the most spectacular women who became community leaders. Mm. Those community leaders were trained. They became the, you know, the head of the message board. If someone came in new, like mm. a newbie, like someone coming into a cocktail party, mm-hmm. you know, and they didn't know anyone there, this community leader would say, you know, hi, Mary, you know, can I help you? And it could be, yeah, you know, I need to find out information. I just found out I had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And this person would lead them both to the content, because mm-hmm. content still mattered to get, mm-hmm. you know, real solid medical advice. But here's also a support group over here who's meeting every Wednesday night. You might want to, you know, sit in on that next week and see if that might work for you.
You know, it's easy.
So that community leader part, it's like to the casual observer, they wouldn't even know that existed.
Right.
And to a casual media observer, they wouldn't know it existed.
Right.
But to somebody who knows the web, that was where everything was happening.
Well, but also, it's so easy to overlook now how much of what is going on in this era is educating people. This is what the web can do. This is how you do it. This is how you behave. Like, a lot of these community sites are training Americans, people worldwide, on this is how you have an online life.
Yes. And how you, I love that when you said how you behave, because AOL, certainly, you know, the grandfather of it, had what they called TOS. There were these rules, you know, and if you behave badly, you got kicked out of class.
Terms of service.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So that was a good beginning. But we thought, okay, that's like the behavioral issue. We now want to get a little more sophisticated about it. And we have a community leader guidebook. It's, you know, like a 3-inch binder, which came out of the community leaders giving their tips for how to, you know, if there's a ruckus, you know, if two people are really at diametrically opposite points of view, like on immunizations, for instance, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. political back then.
Sure.
How can you have a civil conversation? Mm-hmm. So a lot of this, I love the way you said it, you know, learning how to behave, because mm-hmm. it's a whole new way, yeah, of behaving. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about the doorbell?
So, remember at the beginning of this episode when I mentioned that this was a star-crossed interview session? Nancy was kind enough to host me in her home in Manhattan, and it was at this point that we got a visit at the front door from the New York City Fire Department. Apparently, there was an electrical fire out in the street outside, and they needed to check the basement to make sure that the fire was not spreading to the houses from the street. So that's a new one. Haven't had an interview interrupted by a fire alarm before. But we continued after a short time.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
All right, so we were talking about the others training people to behave on the web. Where I wanted to go was I wanted to talk a little bit about you guys. So you and Candace are essentially co-founders in almost the classical sense, but like Candace takes the CEO title, so she's sort of running the business end, and you're running the content and editorial end. What was that like to work as, you know, a co-founding team?
It was actually my husband who said, you know, the two of you really ought to do something together. Mm-hmm. So just so you know, I mean, my husband was the one who said, so we were actually thinking of things we could do together, the two of us, in part because we usually were the only two women in a room, you know, at various meetings that we wound up attending. So when it came time to, like, you know, who does what, our joke was always that we could almost overlap each other, you know, 80%. So we just had to, you know, divide and conquer. And content for me, or creating the programming, since I was coming from, you know, having developed Family Life, I was in that zone, you know, of doing parenting. Although Candace would be here, we had a huge, like, 6-foot roll of paper that we rolled from that end of the room down here. Mm-hmm. And that's, we drew parent soup on it. And Candace was certainly here, you know, as we did that part of it. And I was certainly flying on planes to talk to sponsors. So we overlap, but we said at the end of the day, one's got to get the, you know, create the sites and be with the women, and the other's got to go out with the business. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it was generally a successful dividing up of duties, a successful partnership in general.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into the crazy times. You know, the IPO, the point when, you know, iVillage really was, you know, one of the big names, if we think of the .com era as an era. What are your recollections when you look back now, almost 20 years later, on that period when all of a sudden you've created this successful website, this community has grown, you're servicing this community, but now it's becoming something else. Now it's becoming a multi-billion-dollar company. Now you have hundreds of employees and things like that. What was that ride like?
Well, you got to remember, I mean, I'm old. So, I mean, as Ad Age said, you know, they described Candace and I as, you know, media vets, you know, enter the web. So I'd already worked it, and so had Candace. I'd already worked at big companies. I'd already had lots of people reporting to me, had to report to Wall Street. So that part of it wasn't so new. I thought the kind of the surrounding hoopla and the multiples and the, you know, the valuations, they struck me as crazy. And I was quietly pessimistic and maybe even a little angry at the greediness of the of investors. They were the ones who were really driving those valuations and also driving the IPO dates. I'm much more of a you know, stick stick to your knitting and do business the old-fashioned way. So yeah, if I could have done it my way, we wouldn't have IPO'd. Mm-hmm. Because IPO brings in all kinds of, as everyone knows, considerations which don't have to do with growing a good business. They have everything to do with making money for investors.
Lots of pressures that are external to actually running the company.
And I kind of like running businesses and growing them in, rather than...
Well, I'll ask you, because I've asked
part of it.
Several people this from that era. Was it that there was a time when it's not just everybody's going public, so why don't we, but you have to, like the pressure becomes overwhelming that you have to join this club?
Personally, I could have resisted, but our it didn't come from the number of IPOs happening in our kind of graduating class at that point. It was, well, actually, I'll take you back. When we were first raising money, and because we called ourselves a media company, as you said, that we were in the business of creating media, not the not in the tech business, a number of our investors or potential investors said, well, then, will we get a return on our investment within a year? I said, within a year? I said, the metric in traditional publishing is 5 to 6 years. Which it still is.
Right.
So we were, I mean, for me, I was hearing crazy turnaround on when you would make make a profit. And eventually the investors, they're the one who were revved up by what they were seeing happening. And they were the ones who wanted us to go public. Mm-hmm. We had the numbers to go public, by the way. I mean, in that way, our numbers were fantastic. I mean, we were in the top in terms of brand recognition. We were off the charts. We were always in the top 15 or top 20 largest websites on the planet at that
and
point.
And I believe at the point of going public, you're doing more than 10 million in revenue a quarter. So this is obviously ramping up to get to some decent.
I think we were more than that by that point.
No? Possibly.
Yeah.
I will double check.
I think we were more than that.
But also, you know, adding to the hoopla is that you're one of those stocks that had one of those insane run-ups.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at one point, you know, is above $130 a share.
Yeah.
I think your first day pop was one of those huge first day pops and things like that.
Yeah, we were the sixth largest IPO in the history of the world when we went.
So it's...
And I was depressed that day. I need to put that down on the record. And everyone at iVillage, I think, knew that. We're supposed to be all excited. There is a picture of me the day after we IPO, on the front page of the business section of the New York Times, with me holding a cigar. Meanwhile, at that party, I was like in the corner, just so sad, because I was happy for all these people who had worked with us. I mean, we had the greatest group of people. As my daughter, who's now 27, who was just a kid back then, she went, Mommy, these are some of the greatest people ever. They're so smart. They're so nice. And they are. And that night, many of them were making the kind of money they could pay back their student loans. You know, a single mom who worked with me, she was then able to buy a house. I mean, it was a wonderful night for a lot of them. I, because I'm older and have been around, I am so sad, because I know being public, we're not our own ship anymore. So I am sad. PR person comes over to me and says, Nancy, New York Times photographer is here and he wants to take a picture of you. You've got to come over here and you also have to put a smile on your face. Mm. Leads me over, sits me down. The rest of the gang does have cigars. They go, Nancy, you would hold up the cigar. Anyway, and there's the picture. And I'm surrounded by all my iVillage friends, and the picture, they silhouette me out, and there I am, looking like I'm the, you know, the smug Monopoly guy, which is just the opposite of what I was.
You know, I'm this is almost a parenthetical, but I'm wondering if it was a New York thing, because I had to talk when I spoke to the DoubleClick guys, and I spoke to Craig Kanarek, who was at the name is escaping me right now, but I'll edit in the correct name. I feel like New York-based companies got all this media crap. And especially maybe you guys, because you came from publishing, which this town
there's a lot of people in publishing. And so here you are on the New York Times smoking a cigar. And look, she's this fat cat runs over to the internet and, you know, is making more money than we'll ever see. Was there some sort of like local resentment in New York to these sudden new internet companies?
Oh, I don't blame. I mean, I don't blame.
Yeah.
That's it. Whatever I look like on the cover of New York Times, I wouldn't, you know, I would be resentful of that person too. Yeah, I think there was tremendous resentment. Both partly because we're women. I think I need to keep saying that because that was part of it, and part of it, as you say, yes, is that we came out of New York. I would say the other part of it is that when I went downtown, literally in New York, you go downtown to begin a web play. The people I knew from traditional publishing who were still eating lunch at this place called Michael's, you know, which is a restaurant where all the bold-faced media meet. And I went there for lunch one day and was telling some traditional media people I was going to go down and do this thing called iVillage. And they went, Nancy, you know, that's really, do you really want to do that? You know, that's just, it'll never happen. And they really thought I was making a bad move. So given that they were such serious naysayers, they being really all pretty much all traditional publishing, to be such naysayers and then see someone like me smoking the cigar, they were like, you got to be kidding. They're most of those people now, besides the fact that if they had a magazine, it's now gone, or they are now all on the web.
Right.
And there's not any of them who aren't on the web.
So it's a combination of, you know, initially they want to burst your bubble and bring you back down to size.
Yeah.
But then later on it's jealousy.
And because, then later on they're all right, in it, this right. thing that they all dismissed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we have to talk
and
about...
And I need to say, can
yes,
I just add
sure,
here?
Please.
That there is Amazon beginning to take off. Mm-hmm. And since I did come out of one of my strains of my life was book publishing, I did say to the regios at Barnes & Noble, you know, I said, there's this big thing happening on the web. I mean, they thought I was, anyone I would talk to back then thought I was crazy. And you can sell books there. And actually, I started a book channel at iVillage. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love books so much. We were we were doing books. And they just looked at me like, nah, you know, whatever that is, we're not interested. And particularly, see, that's why I do love the best of business is when, you know, you're doing well at your core business, but you've always got, if not you, you've got people around you who are always looking around the next corner. You know, we had guys, there was this one guy at iVillage named Michael Rose, and he would write me emails at 3 a.m. going, Evans, listen, there's this thing happening out there. We gotta check it out. Like we started member websites, which is really, you know, the early roots of blogs. We began that like in 2001. And it's because, you know, someone within our company was always looking, what's the next thing? Because you gotta keep growing or there's Barnes & Noble with a brick and mortar and things aren't as good as they could have been.
Well, we have to talk about when the bubble does burst. And I ask everyone too, from this time period, did you have a sense, do you remember there was a day or a month or a quarter when all of a sudden you start to see, things seem to be drying up a little bit?
No.
No?
I got to say to you, the bubble bursting to me was the market correcting itself. How could I at iVillage, I went to the women's symposium at General GE, right, to speak to the women there. I get up on the stage, and there's Jack Welch, who at that point is head of GE. Our valuation at iVillage was larger than GE. That is wrong. I mean, that is not right. I mean, it is not right. So for me, the bubble was the correction I'd been waiting for. To me, it was no... I mean, I am quite serious about this. Mm-hmm. To me, it was no surprise because all along I've been going, this is insane. And now remember, while I'm going, this is insane about the business, where I'm really focused still is on this huge movement that is still happening about women coming online. Mm-hmm. So that by the year, first quarter of 2001, there are, for the first time in history, mm-hmm. there are more women on the web than men. Mm-hmm. 2001, first quarter. So that's where I'm living. I'm mm-hmm. living actually with something that is still growing and growing. And to me, the bubble was the bubble. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's... And you stay through it because I think you stay. Until 2003 is when you finally leave.
I believe 2004.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're able to, you know, obviously I can't wait to get to this part of the chronology, but it's not a nuclear winter for everybody because people don't stop using the web. So you're able to see that from your point of view, people are still interacting. They're still and it's evolving into new things.
Well, and also because I don't think. That whole bubble was driven by greed of market. Mm-hmm. I mean, that you got to separate what the market was saying versus what the users and the people were doing. Mm-hmm. Really, I mean, that's like even our economics today. Mm-hmm. You know, if you take what the market's doing versus what real people on the street are doing, they're two different stories. So, as I say, I was really connected to the story of the web, not the. Mm-hmm. Not the
money.
Stock price.
Right, yeah.
And actually, I used to scream at people who were spending half their day looking at the stock price.
Do you ever, we should say for context that I think it's in 2006, iVillage is purchased by NBC Universal.
Right.
So it continues to be a strong brand today. Do you felt like it got a good home?
NBC had been an early, I would say third round kind of investor in us. So they were a good partner with us on for television. I was pretty regularly going on the NBC Evening News because we got very involved in the 2000 presidential election, and we began polling so that we were able to represent the issues that women care about. And we also invited all the presidential candidates onto iVillage and ask them questions that we would get 7,000 questions per mm-hmm. interview with one of the presidential candidates. It was just wonderful. So we were becoming an influencer in that. And we also started working with Dateline, which was an NBC program that was in the news. That was terrific. When NBC Universal outright bought iVillage, they did the old top down. Mm. I mean, it's just classic. Instead of, as we said earlier, kind of the real secret sauce of iVillage was the women and all of the activity that was going on in the chat rooms, the message boards, support groups. I mean, these women were meeting offline. Mm-hmm. These women were on their own dime, mm-hmm. having little conventions all over the country. I mean, that is how meaningful the relationships were. I think what NBC Universal saw was women's website, women's programming, and they pretty soon put on a television show called iVillage, mm-hmm. which was on NBC, and it was the exact opposite of what iVillage was. iVillage was about real women, which means, you know, your hair's not perfect, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which means, I mean, the number one search term in iVillage was under eye circles. You know, like, these women were deprived of sleep. Mm-hmm. Because they're doing all the things women have to do. Well, the women on the show were like young and perky and, you know, perfect blonde hair. And they were fake. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe they're real in their real lives, mm-hmm, but on mm-hmm. this TV show, they were pretty darn fake. Mm-hmm. So it was completely anti-brand. So within short order, you could see. I mean, I still was in contact with a lot of the iVillage women who use the site. You know, they went, this isn't it anymore. It was authentic, mm-hmm. And they did not get that it was the women stupid, mm-hmm. and not the programming from mm-hmm. you know Rockefeller Center. Mm-hmm. So I think unfortunately they blew it.
Well, it might make you feel good to know that when I told my wife I was doing this interview, she said, "Oh, iVillage got me through my pregnancy." So there must still be good content out there.
Yeah. That's it. iVillage got me through my pregnancy. iVillage got me through my breast cancer. iVillage got me through my divorce. Mm-hmm. It was the ultimate, it wasn't iVillage. That's why we called it Village. Mm-hmm. It was all those women together,
sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, who helped each other. It was brilliant.
Well, let's talk about women in tech, which you and I have discussed a little bit over email, but I would have brought this up anyway, because, for example, the New Yorker article about you guys, mm-hmm. there's several other articles I read where I sort of had this sense that the more things change, the more it's the same. And there's these just catty details in so many articles about Candace as a boss or about you as a boss. You know, there's some quote about someone working under you saying, oh, she'll freeze you out and you don't know why. And I'm just wondering, I want you to say whatever you want to say about this topic. But first of all, do you feel that women in business continue to just be misunderstood, or some of the attention that you guys got maybe was negative because you were women?
Yeah. The answer would be big yes. I mean, I pointed out at a Fortune magazine women's summit, we had looked at every one of their magazine covers, and I can't give you the exact year, but let's just put it this way. There'd only been two covers with women on them, and one was a cover story on wives of CEOs. Mm. And I also did a little survey, you know, largely anecdotal, but we went through a lot of issues, to show that when businessmen are written about, it just seems that they fail to mention, oh, he's got a balding head, he's got a paunch, you know, he's got socks that are too short. I mean, you don't hear these particulars about his physique or his sartorial splendor or lack thereof. Whereas a woman cannot be described in a business article without having mention of her hair color, of her, you know, pantsuit, her shoe. It will always be mentioned. And there's not a woman executive who won't tell you that that's the case. Now, until they start talking about men, what men are wearing, what their suits are, and the fact that they, you know, they've got something hanging over their belt, there's something wrong with that, and that needs to be changed. And yes, I do think we're not treated the same.
Well, even
in the press,
like
you know, that is why I got to say, television is infinitely better than the press.
Mm.
We were treated well on Charlie Rose, on the Today Show, 60 Minutes, mm-hmm. Leslie Stahl. You know, we flew in community leaders from all over the country, so Leslie Stahl could interview them for 60 minutes, mm-hmm. and kind of show the country, mm-hmm. you know, here are the kind of people who are using the web. TV did really well by us, but the print, and remember, we're back in New York,
mm-hmm.
They just don't really like
well,
it.
Well, focusing on things like the words they would use is there was a revolving door of executives and consultants, but that's any company that's like that. So why was that what they focused on with you guys? And
well, I mean, I think they focus on it with they can focus on that with other companies as well. I think they really like the storyline of the mercurial Candace. And I think what Candace would say is when you're growing a business at close to the speed of light, the kinds of, for instance, due diligence you would do on acquisitions, you know, if you did it textbook B-school way, it wasn't allowable in the time you had to either go with an acquisition or not go with it, because things were going that fast, mm-hmm. you know, in the web, in the early web days. You had to get to that deal or you would lose it. And people were making those kind of, you know, acquisition deals when the primary metric was, you know, reach, your size. So there was a lot of activity going on then. And so you did move fast, and you can make wrong moves, and that means you made a wrong move, you need to let that person go. I mean, that is true. And with a startup, you just can't keep baggage behind you. You got to get onto the next thing.
Right.
I mean, I got to say, I did fire someone after 17 days, which I remember to this day because it was 17 days. Mm-hmm. And it's because she was leading one of our major sites, and she said one day, you know, I don't know why, you know, if a mother needs to get an answer on something like this, she doesn't go to her local playground. And I said, this is her playground. Mm-hmm. This is where she's going to talk to other mothers. Mm-hmm. And a few more days like that, and she, you know, I realized she just didn't really get it. She didn't believe in it. And I said, you know, I think we need to part ways. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can get on with your life and we can continue ours.
Well, I hope the audience will forgive me I hope I'm not putting too much of my own personal opinions into this, but I'm thinking of, I remember how the press treated Carly Fiorina when she was head of HP. And I'm thinking specifically of like the fascination with Marissa Meyer now. I almost feel like the business press especially feels like a woman CEO, a woman in charge of a tech company maybe specifically, is, wow, isn't this such an interesting experiment? We'll see how long this will go. You know what I mean? Like the skepticism with which people treat everything that Marissa Meyer is doing seems to me.
Well, I mean, she was just in the Times today reporting her earnings, which mm-hmm. still, you know, she is still in the beginnings of a turnaround, right. Not a turnaround. And notice they will always have a picture of her mm-hmm. because she's attractive mm-hmm. and she's blonde. Mm-hmm. I think that adds to it. I mean, when you look at the business press, they got, you know, guys. And so it kind of makes the page sparkle when they put in a girl.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. One last question in this area. I believe your daughter is maybe entrepreneurial and exploring
bet.
Things in tech. And you've mentioned to me over email, like, you know, there were a lot of women early on in the internet era, in the web era. And just any thoughts that you have in terms of the contributions women have already made and hopefully the contributions that women can make more going forward?
First of all, I'm sure people give you kudos all the time, but I'm just so happy, really, that you're doing this, because of the missing history of the web really is women. You know, when Walter Isaacson, in his book, The Innovators, has an illustrated timeline, and when you get to 1994 and 1995, it still pictures of men, and certainly men were the ones creating, you know, tech revolution, but how could it not be considered a revolution to take what really, I mean, the computer at that point was an appliance, then you had a thing called the modem, and to take it from nowhere with women and make it, I would say we were a primary driver of making it an indispensable tool for women. That's a revolution. And we made that happen. That has got to go down in the history books. And women got the webbiness of the web. I mean, they're women are the ultimate connectors, mm-hmm. right? They're the ones who mm-hmm. connect people. They say more words per day than men. Mm-hmm. You know, the web was made for them, mm-hmm. not in terms of tech, but in terms of what it could do. That is what women brought to it, is what can this thing do to make lives better?
The application of
it. The application of it. You know, there was this thing called the Million Mom March, mm-hmm. where millions of mothers went down to Washington, D.C. to protest about all these shootings that were going on in playgrounds and in schools. The Million Mom March organized at iVillage. Like, we didn't organize it. But if you had your ear to the ground and listened to the message boards, no matter if it was on losing weight, you know, or starting, you know, home business, women were all in there saying, "I'll meet you at the corner of Vine and, you know, Pine tomorrow at 8. And then they all went down to Washington. Mm-hmm. I mean, you couldn't have organized that kind of movement without the web, mm-hmm. without a place like iVillage.
Well, my final question is the generic one that I do for everybody, but being as how all this stuff is 20 years ago.
It's 20 years ago.
When you look back, the launch of iVillage, if it's 1995.
Yeah.
When you look back, mm-hmm. what do you feel? Pride? Exhaustion? Mm-hmm. I can't believe we did that. Mm-hmm. I could never do that again. You know, what do you feel?
I feel really blessed. you know, the Canis came into my life, that we brought together the group of people we were able to bring together to create this thing called iVillage. I just, to have created, you know, a movement on the web, I feel it's the proudest, I feel so proud of it. And you mentioned my daughter. She was a little kid attending the meetings that we had in our house. And it was a joke around here that if someone came to the door, she gave them a pad and a pencil because she thought they were coming to a meeting. And she's now working on a project, and I'm helping her with it, where she thinks that mobile apps are kind of at the primitive stage that the web was when we started iVillage 25 years ago. So what she's looking at now is making apps more navigatable, accessible, curatable for women. And she says a few good men too, because I always say to her, you know, if you make it good for women, it'll also be good for men. But if you only make it good for men, it probably won't be good for women. So she's about to start that business. Mm-hmm. And I think how cool. I mean, we're going to do the next generation of stuff with women in mind.
I hope so. Nancy Evans, thank you for coming on the Internet History Podcast and remembering all that great stuff for us.
Thank you.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod. And my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.